As I've waded through this pandemic, I've explored a lot of things, from my bed to my kitchen table, but I've also explored a lot of Netflix. A lot of it, and in all kinds of genres. Something that caught my attention, though, was sort of the allure of Korean media, which Helen knows a lot about.
Oh, and we've been new.
Yeah, we've been new. But I just kind of recently got into it. I mean, I was already into, say, K-pop with amazing bands like Red Velvet that populate my Spotify, which is awesome, by the way, and you should definitely listen to Red Velvet. But I've recently made my way towards K-dramas, a genre you're familiar with, potentially. I started with Crash Landing on You, which is one of my favorite shows of all time. After I finished the glorious first season of possibly the best show ever made, in my opinion, Helen has still not watched it, and honestly like, yeah, you should be ashamed of that.
And also, normally Korean dramas are only one season, so it's likely that the show is over.
No, they're definitely doing another season.
Oh, they've announced it?
I think so.
Because that's uncommon. They don't usually do second season.
Well, they are for this one. It's the best show of all time.
Okay.
But after I finished this show, I turned on this other show that I found on Netflix called Rookie Historian, mainly because that is what I am, kind of, and I like the costumes. But it wasn't a show about amateur podcasters. It's a show about historians in the 19th century. Same thing, kind of. Specifically in 19th century Joseon Korea. It opened my eyes to this sort of unique system. A system where historians recorded the goings-on of a palace, from national affairs to everyday activities, with extreme credibility. Much more credibility than a lot of people have nowadays in, say, tweets, for instance. These records were guaranteed independence and secrecy, which helped create a seemingly accurate portrayal of Korean history. This made us think about how we record history, how we tell it, how we teach it. So today we are going to dive into the Korean history keepers, the inevitable and preventable bias in history, and some modern battles with how we currently teach and preserve history. Welcome to Not So Familiar History. I'm David Cirillo.
And I'm Helen Gunn.
Today, the annals of the Joseon Dynasty are considered a global treasure. They are a compilation of history surrounding the palace and Joseon for over four centuries. And by the way, in case I didn't already say, Joseon was Korea. It's virtually the same thing. It encompasses both North and South Korea, plus a little bit more land to the north. And it is what Korea was called before the modern states were formed. Anywho, these annals, compiled over four centuries from 1413 to 1865, are an immense feat. Now inscribed on the UNESCO Memory of the World Register and available in multiple translations across the world and on the trusty internet, it took a lot of persistence to keep these annals independent and factual. And the mere fact, along with their survival throughout the centuries, makes people marvel with interest. Including us, I mean, like, come on. The Joseon Annals cover the 472-year history of the Joseon Dynasty, from the first ruler, King Taizo, to the 25th ruler, King Joseon, and were prepared according to strict compilation standards. The only exclusions are the records of King Gojong, the 26th ruler, and King Sunjong, the 27th and final ruler, because these records were prepared during the Japanese colonial period and did not comply with the impartiality and strict compilation standards that existed for centuries prior. Side note, I really apologize if I am butchering any and all names during the course of this podcast. Please forgive me. I will try to do better regardless. The Joseon Annals consist of 1,893 volumes and are arranged by chronological order, including the events of every single day during the entire 472-year history. Every single day. But how are these records compiled? Even if you didn't ask, I'm going to answer. While a monarch ruled over Joseon, professional historians collected documents and wrote daily accounts of state affairs, diplomatic incidences, daily life at large, climactic changes, economic wins, and everything imaginable. These drafts, called the Sacho, were kept secret. They couldn't be read by anyone besides the history keepers, not even by the king or the queen. And if a history keeper disclosed the contents of their writings or dared to change something, they would be punished with beheading. Yes, kind of intense. After the death of the king, the Office for Annals Compilation, composed of senior ranking officials, would be established to oversee the compilation of the annals of the relevant king. And the annals were compiled based on daily records and other reference materials, such as the records kept by government departments. One of the key source documents for these compilations were the daily records of the Royal Secretariat, which were written by history keepers following the king and recording everything they saw and heard. This independence and formation was challenged, however, specifically by King Yeon Sang-gun, monarch in the late 15th century. And this monarch did actually try to peer into the annals. Keep in mind, they weren't that old at the time, not even a century old yet. But the king didn't really like what he saw, leading to the first literary purge of 1498, known as Muosawa. And I am saying that in a known sort of like American accent because I'm afraid I'll butcher it and either say it with a French or Arabic accent otherwise.
I apologize for bringing that to your attention.
It is okay. I realized it myself as well. Now, there was a grudge between two historians, Yi Guk-dun and Kim Il-sun. Both were assigned to compile records related to King Seonjong's reign for the annals of the Joseon Dynasty. But Kim Il-sun, one of these two historians in this little grudge match, was a disciple of another Kim, Kim Jong-jik, who was critical of King Seju's usurpation in the annals. Now, to clarify who all these players in this Game of Thrones-esque drama are, King Seju actually committed a coup against his predecessor earlier in Joseon history. And Kim Jong-jik was quite critical of this coup. In a representation of his criticism, he wrote a lamentation from a bit of Chinese history. Specifically, he wrote a lamentation of Zhang Yu's murder of Emperor Yi of Chu in an early Chinese history, after he heard of the king's death at the order of King Seju. When Yi Guk-dun, who was again the other historian in this grudge match, and Kim Il-sun's superior found this out, he sensed a chance for revenge. Kim Il-sun and other followers of Kim Jong-jik were accused of treason by many who gained power from their support of Seju. But Yeon Sang-gun's lineage came from Seju. Therefore, this critical view of Seju's usurpation was considered to be treasonous. Yeon Sang-gun, who disliked academia, very opposite of Helen and me, was notorious for turning the royal study hall into his personal brothel.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That's like, he's like living my dreams, but like by accident.
What?
Because like, no, one of my dreams is to basically like to make out with someone in the library stacks. Like that's like one of my
dreams. Helen, that's not really this. This is...
I guess not. I mean, like, it's not a brothel.
Like, your dream is to have a brothel in a library?
It's been my dream since I was a young girl. I have to be an entrepreneur somehow. I don't know.
Christian.
No, so it's not the same as the brothel, but what I'm saying is that he's getting up to stuff in the stacks, just like I want to someday.
This pauses for dramatic effect. Okay, well, in this study hall that was turned into a personal brothel, which is now Helen's dream, apparently, this king found an opportunity to purge the Sarim scholars, the group that criticized this usurpation committed by King Seju. Kim Il-sun, who was, again, I keep saying this to keep people sort of in the mode of the story, one of the two stories in the grudge match, and two others were drawn and quartered. In this case, meaning each of their limbs was pulled apart by an ox, and three others were beheaded. Kim Jong-jik, who was Kim Il-sun's mentor, had his remains excavated, and then he too was beheaded, and at least 18 others were exiled. King Yeon Sang-gun ordered the entire court to actually watch Kim Il-sun's execution by ox, and even ordered that those who did not attend or turn their face away be reported so that they might be punished. And that is some true Game of Thrones stuff, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. We never got Kim Jong-jik's death story.
Well, he died like way earlier. He never died in this period because he's his mentor. He was way older.
Okay, we're good.
This event, however, led to greater protections for the Historians and the Annals in general, specifically in preventing any monarch from laying their eyes on them.
And I really love that these protections allowed the historians to record history in a way that it was accessible to their perhaps unknown and unimagined future readers. Historical records, especially of nobility and their exploits, have always been very contentious in the European West. After all, with divine despots, it was nigh impossible to get protection against the king. How could you possibly ask for protection against an instrument of God? I can already hear the fires crackling. Dissenters or even truthful observers could be greatly harmed if they said or proclaimed something that could be skewed as anti-church or anti-monarch. In pre-revolutionary France, our boys Diderot and Jean-Laurent d'Alembert wrote the Encyclopedia as a record of history and their enlightened present. However, they had to be very sneaky about how they revealed information. You know how encyclopedias give you entries about a topic and then direct you to a new topic to help flesh things out?
No, I've never heard of an encyclopedia.
Okay, well, let's say our modern encyclopedia, like Wikipedia, you can click the hyperlinks and you'll get more information about something else in the article.
Wikipedia.
That's like what like old encyclopedias did too, though. Except instead of you having hyperlinks, you'd have to like look for the thing in another page.
Oh my god, I've never done that before.
Oh man. The Frenchman designed it this way so that they could hide interpretations within the book itself. I was like super lucky to get my hands on one of the first editions of the encyclopedia while taking French lit at Rice. But there was an article about the pyramids and the hubris of building such monuments to oneself. They were basically talking about the pridefulness of nobility and how ridiculous their exploits were. Guess who they were digging at, basically?
Who?
The king of France.
France had a king?
Yes.
Wow. I can't believe we did an episode kind of related to that called Little House in the Petit Trianon, which you should listen to.
I know, right?
Wow.
Anyway, these things were like hidden though in these articles where you'd read one thing and then you'd have to go to the next. And so like this sort of like chain reaction of you going from one article to the next to find out more, that was how they were able to hide these sort of dissenting views without getting into trouble.
And that's amazing. But what's even more amazing is the fact that they didn't really need to hide in Joseon Korea in terms of their views because they were so protected.
It's wild to me. It's wonderful. I love it.
Well, in the later Joseon period, there was intense conflict between different political factions. And some rival factions actually did try to revise draft histories. But again, the protections were pretty great. These revisions were identified and removed, and somehow, these original histories have remained intact. The historians managed to record every single word and act of the king in their drafts. Though the final copies of the annals were, of course, pruned, like a nice plant, a nice basil leaf, perhaps. But imagine how long they would be otherwise. They would be unreadable. Even the tiniest details were recorded. For instance, King Taejong, another 15th century king, fell from a horse and told those in his company to not alert any historian of the incident. Incidentally, a historian not only recorded that fall, but the king's words not to record it in the first place. Even some of the more fantastical elements of rookie historian, like the hijinks with costumes and disguises and some light stalking, are based in some kind of truth. King Taejong, for instance, was recorded complaining about a historian who eavesdropped on him behind a screen and followed him to a hunt behind a disguise. There's a lot of hijinks, and I quite respect it.
They're like the opposite of the Scooby-Doo villains.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They're like, who are you, Scooby? And they turn, and it's a bush that's recording their every word. But multiple copies of the annals were made throughout history, and the methods actually improved too. After the 1450s, annals were printed and printed with movable metal and wood type, unprecedented for any country in the region. Most of the five surviving copies of the annals were damaged in one way or another, but what we do have is now preserved, online and in physical form, in the original classical Chinese, as well as in Korean and sometimes English. In my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful and exhaustive exercises in historical record keeping ever to exist. And it makes you wonder, of course, history is written by the victors. We only know what the historians were told or were allowed to know. And even recording the words of the king, each and every word, mind you, these words would be pro-Joseon, but nonetheless, these records peer through the screen of pretense and secrecy and have since become a trusted resource to picture both the sort of full bird's eye view and day-to-day goings-on of the Joseon dynasty, an amazingly detailed first-hand account with unparalleled accuracy. There are some heroic parallels in modern-day society, but also some troubling comparisons of history being altered to push an agenda in the Koreas, the United States, and around the world. And that's what we're going to discuss next.
Yes, and before we really get to that trouble of accuracy, I do want to first talk about the very heroic historians that live in our modern digital age. I'm going to talk about digital archivists, but before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about what archives are. So contrary to what my students believe, an archive is not the same as a library, though it is often housed in a library. Libraries give us finished products, sort of curated information. When researching in a library, we are searching for specific things. These more curated collections streamline our process, giving us the information we know we are looking for, with commentary or author interpretations already provided. If you read a history book, you're reading at a slant. Information is interpreted by the author, so there really isn't an unbiased account. Take, for instance, the biography I read for the Virginia Woolf episode we had a few weeks ago. Hermione Lee took the primary documents, letters, journal entries, etc., and formed them into a more or less cohesive narrative about Woolf's life. Actions had causes and reactions. However, we, as experienced life livers, understand that life is not a narrative. To make it so would be to add or omit truths. Anyway, all that is to say that libraries contain biased texts. They are unbiased in that they hold some of everything, but the texts themselves look at life with a biased lens. Archives, on the other hand, are not interpreted, narrativized accounts. They are a mass of primary sources, eyewitness accounts, letters, drawings, photos, journals, news articles, waiting for researchers to find and interpret them. Archives are also interesting in that they are organized in such a way that alert you what is there, but not what is being said. So in my work at the archive at the Burns Rare Book Library at Boston College while I was getting my master's before I set foot on this hellhole, I'd pull from multiple boxes at once. So I'd look for information that would help me with my research on theater productions of Beckett's Endgame. But the fun thing was that I never knew what exactly I was going to get. I found gems, like Beckett's cease and desist letter to the ART Theater in Boston, and less useful tidbits, like an old art poster advertising a rendition of another one of Beckett's plays. The thing is, no one interpreted these for me. I was given the opportunity to read history through artifacts with fresh eyes and come to my own conclusions.
So you interpreted it and made your own biases.
Yes, exactly. I mean, writing in general, analyzing, creating like your papers, your research, that's always going to be biased and it's always going to be sort of skewed to your opinion. Okay, anyway, if my explanation of archives is still a little bit foggy, you have your own archives. So look at your camera roll or your Facebook page, even your family photo albums.
Look at your Farmville.
Yes! These are all personal documentations of your life as you live it. No pesky historian interpreting events for you in sight. So now that we have archives under our belts, let's talk about today's historian heroes. Founded 20 years ago, the Library of Congress's web archive has tasked itself with preserving the internet and all its crazy content. Of course, the internet wasn't the weird hellscape it is today back when this archive started. Yes. The internet was less fidgety when the head of the internet archival program, Abby Grotke, took over in 2002, 2 years after the program's nascence. When Grotke took over, the archive consisted of one person going through newspapers for mentions of websites. It has grown now to a team of five. However, a team of five is very small when this archive works to preserve not just news, but also defunct blogs, web comics, the lolcat Bible, and basically any other open access media. There's also the fact that the internet expands at a speed that feels as fast as that of the universe, with new content being created and lost every second.
How fast or slow are they at preserving this content, do you think, considering there are only five people?
I know, there's only five of them. They're just like constantly working. What's happened is that they have to work so quickly and basically archive these products that their archive, the archive itself, which is available to us, we can get on this archive. It's not user-friendly at all because they just do not have the time to program it to be such when they have to preserve all of these things at lightning pace and there's only five of them.
I feel very bad for those who are tasked with preserving Twitter during Trump presidency.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, these guys are doing that. Their busiest season is election season because they're preserving the media, all of the commentary from citizens. It's just like, it's crazy. And I mean, I imagine this presidency was crazy enough. And then the pandemic hit and they had to start working from home. I'm like, if you look at like the storage system and stuff like that, like it looks almost like those computers back when computers were first invented, like they're as big as a room. And it's because they have like, it's like entire petabytes of knowledge. It's incredible. Anyway, but what I was saying before, new content is being created and lost every second. And that's right, I said lost. Because sites time out, server costs are too much to keep content online, and for an archive that has an opt-in policy, the permissions the archivists ask for through email often go to spam folders or reach a person who has already passed away. Remember when we were kids and we were told whatever we post online stays there forever? That's not the case. The archivists feel the loss when a well-loved site goes to Digital Elysium before it can be archived. As a side note, I want to let you know, however, that any public tweet you tweeted before 2017 has been archived by the Library of Congress.
Good. They should know my brilliance.
Yes. Of course, the archivists do have strict criteria that they adhere to. Basically, they look for whether or not the media is of use to future scholars, has cultural value, or is unique. However, the brief digital imprint of these sites demand a speed that five people in the vastness of the internet cannot be expected to conquer. Currently, however, the archivists have managed to collect over 2 petabytes of data, some 18 billion digital documents. The work of these people, their dogged determination in the face of this Herculean task, makes them heroes in my book, even if they aren't in danger of being drawn and quartered.
Oh, we don't know that yet.
That's true, but they are doing their best to record the internet's history as it occurs. But while the archivists work to preserve history as is, our own educations prove that history is inherently biased. Take, for instance, high school's desire to speak about Manifest Destiny without really going over the Trail of Tears and the horrible treatment of the U.S.'s indigenous people. Or perhaps the sudden addition of Hawaii to our maps, but our neglect to mention our takeover of the land from a queen and her people, all who protested profusely against the loss of their birthright. Salient right now to me, because I am teaching a Holocaust unit in my English classes, is the fact that boats full of European Jewish refugees came to the shores of America for asylum, only to be sent back to the dangers of concentration camps where many of them would die. Not something we cover in history classes. Instead, America is the strong, true, brave force that showed up late, won Europe victory over Germany, and freed the many from horrific concentration camps. Of course, we forget to mention we inadvertently sent some of their inhabitants into the clutches of German prejudices, while also conveniently omitting the fact that the U.S. had its own internment camps for Japanese Americans.
Korematsu versus the United States.
Thank you. And of course, one cannot overlook the states' rights narrative pushed in Texas schools to explain the reasons for the Civil War. States' rights may have been one of the reasons for the Civil War, but the whole states' rights idea was clung upon as it determined the right of a state to decide if its inhabitants would be free to own slaves. And this takes us to the sad fact of history. Without archives, history really exists in the form of narratives written by the victors. hence the US's shady narrative pushed to school children, or the omission of the stories of defeated foes. To call back to a previous episode of this podcast, I don't really know much about the pagans who were executed in the name of Christianity. I just know they were executed in order for Christianity to reign supreme. Again, winners tell the story, losers are silenced, or often dead.
As Freddie Mercury once said, we are the champions.
Thank you for lightening this up.
These winners can bend history to their liking. For instance, the annals of the last two Joseon rulers, Kojong Siluk and Sunjong Siluk, and generally excluded from the Joseon annals, mainly because both were completed at the cusp of Japanese colonization. They excluded these documents because they were unreliable. Japanese officials not only had to sway in their compilation, but even changed and made up events to fit their colonialist narrative. These two annals were saved as a separate document, however, but it goes to show how special the process really was and how unique it was to the Joseon dynasty. It's so easily changed how you can just inject bias, and that didn't end with Japanese colonization. After World War II, Korea broke free from Japanese occupation, but it was caught in the Cold War. The Soviets had influence in the North, the Americans in the South. And I could go on for hours and hours about this. I have listened to other podcasts, watched documentaries, read books about North Korea and this split. I don't know why. I have been obsessed with it for many years. But the Soviets had influence in the North, like I said. And splitting of these countries was kind of against a lot of different tenets of international humanity and even law at times. But in any case, the North did exist. And Stalin needed someone who was popular to rule it. A puppet state, if you will. Kim Il-sung spent a lot of his youth in Manchuria and later on the Soviet Union, a byproduct of being on the run from the Japanese while, allegedly at least, fighting against them. And Kim Il-sung idolized Stalin. He was the perfect fit to rule the North. A puppet that loved Stalin and honestly could be controlled. But his admiration for Stalin morphed into a sort of pseudo-Stalinism in North Korea, which was a system based off of a cult of personality in order to rule with a mandate and an iron fist. This ideology, when mixed with an enhanced focus on self-reliance, duty, and self-defense, came to be known as Juche. The history of North Korea stands in almost polar opposite to the trusted annals of Joseon Korea. In Korean history, nowadays at least, and I'm talking about North Korea, Kim Il-sung stayed in Korea and fought the Japanese, beating them almost single-handedly through guerrilla warfare in World War II. This is known to be false pretty much everywhere else, because it left out the assistance from China and various other actors. But again, this is only history outside of North Korea. Within the state, Kim did it all himself. He awarded himself made-up awards, publicized made-up accolades from international leaders, and realized that propaganda was a means to sustain his regime. Kim Jong-il, his son, was born on Mount Paektu, a storied and important place in Korean history in both the North and the South. Here, at his father's secret base, he was born in 1942. Except he was actually born in the USSR sometime earlier. People think 1941. His birth was heralded by a swallow, caused winter to change to spring, a star to illuminate the sky, reminds me of Bafana, and a double rainbow even. The cult of personality has persisted. News is filtered. Many can decipher what is fact from fiction. For instance, is Kim Jong-un the latest in this godlike dynasty that has persisted through fortune and war, then famine and poverty? Dead? Is he alive? Did he fake his death to purge dissenters? Knowledge is power, and that is held dear in North Korea, and it provides a perfect contrast. Knowledge preserved for power beyond truth versus knowledge preserved for the sake of truth. Also, another plug for the amazing show that's crash landing on you, set in North Korea and oddly accurate in showcasing a lot of North Korean life. And a plug that is slightly more academic in its telling of history. I really, really recommend the book Nothing to Envy, which is all about firsthand accounts from refugees from North Korea about very recent life in the country is extraordinarily interesting.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
You're welcome, Helen.
I bet you never realized historians and archivists were so cool. But also, isn't it strange to think how such jobs can be dangerous? That they can put you at risk in places like North Korea or even sometimes in the US. Knowledge is power, but the truth is even more powerful. Whatever truth really means.
With that in mind, let's all try to be archivists, if only to document our own lives. Or put our own lives at risk.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Not So Familiar History, The History Keepers.
Please make sure to listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. We are on pretty much everything, and rate us on sites like Apple Podcasts if you feel so moved. We have a new episode out every other Friday, and we look forward to making them for you.